Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Powered by Righteous Media.
Welcome to Independent Americans. Welcome to episode 142. I'm your host, Paul Rykoff. And even Thanksgiving is a time to stay vigilant. Thanksgiving is a time for reflection, for family, and to be thankful. And I just want to thank all of you for supporting this show over the last year and over the last few years. So this Thanksgiving, there's much to be thankful for. And in particular, I am thankful for the courage and leadership of a former regular guest on this show, a returning champion, the great and powerful Rob Serra. On September 11th of this year, he launched his own podcast with us here at Righteous Media. It's called the Firefighters Podcast with Rob Serra. It's brave, it's fierce, it's funny, and it gets into firefighting life, stories of heroism, and cooking recipes from his really fantastic sidekick, Frankie, his daughter. We're really proud of this podcast, and if you haven't heard it before, we want to share an episode with you now, give you a little taste, give you a special dessert after a hearty season of eating. The Firefighters started as a part of Independent Americans. Many of you have supported Rob, and I hope you'll now continue to support him and this new podcast. Check out this special episode of The Firefighters with Rob Serra. Be sure to subscribe to his show and share it. It'll give you reason to be thankful, not just on Thanksgiving, but every day. As Rob likes to say, stay low. And as I always say, of course, stay vigilant. And happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, guys. Welcome to the very first episode of the Firefighters Podcast. I'm Rob Serra. I'm a retired New York City firefighter, a 9/11 first responder, an accidental activist, an advocate, a volunteer, a husband, but most importantly, I'm a father. Today's guest is recently retired New York City firefighter Rich Navioski. I'm excited to bring you his mission of positivity. He's a poet, a father, a husband, and a hero. He's a keeper of the light. We'll also hear from our cooking correspondent, my daughter, Frankie. Like the firehouse itself, this show is going to be all about family. So we're going to welcome you into ours. Hopefully you'll welcome us into yours. And you'll continue to listen, subscribe, tell your friends, and join us every Friday. During my time as an advocate and an activist, a lot of people have given me their platform to spread my message. So now I want to do my part, you know? I want to give other people an opportunity to spread their message and pay it forward. My good friend Ray used to say, do the right thing even when no one is looking. But you know what? I think it's important to shine a light on those people out there doing the right thing. I think we need to find out who the helpers are. I think those are the people we need to lift up and look up to. We're proud to have a new sponsor for the show, Rocky Boots. Since 1932, Rocky Boots has had a proud legacy building boots for the men and women who serve and protect our country. And in January, Rocky is introducing their fire boots. As with all Rocky boots, these are high quality, comfortable, and built to last. Plus, these boots are NFPA certified. Located in an American small town, Rocky has volunteer firefighters in their company, and their focus is on footwear that's innovative and durable. Rocky is currently looking for firefighters to wear test their boots. If you're interested, reach out through any of Rocky Boots' social media channels, Facebook and Twitter, at Rocky Gear. And be sure to check out the great deals at rockyboots.com. Rocky Boots, rugged innovation since 1932. So, without further ado, I'm happy to bring you all the one and only Rich Navioski. Joining me today is a good friend and colleague, the one, Richard Naviosky. Rich is a retired FDNY firefighter, recently retired, and recently moved across the country, which we'll get to. But yeah, I'm not going to waste any time. I want to introduce everyone to Rich because I'm excited for you to meet him. Rich, welcome.
Thank you very much. Not too many people get excited to meet me, so I appreciate that, you know?
Well, it's usually after they meet you that they're not very
excited. That's true. They get excited to meet me, and then they wish they hadn't pretty soon after, you know?
So Rich and I are a bit of kindred spirits, right? Both English majors.
Yeah.
Both stumbled our way into the FDNY. Rich.
Both hilarious.
Rich is a graduate of the University of Delaware. Is that correct?
I would say that that's not true. I attempted to be a graduate of the University of Delaware, but, you know, the drugs and alcohol kind of shortened that for me. So I wound up graduating from UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Oh, all right. All right. Joe Flacco did not attend that school, though, did he?
Nah, he didn't. He didn't. But, you know, when it comes to Joe Flacco, I am a blue hen all the way, you know.
So how does one make their way from Maryland to the mean streets of the West Village? Tell us how you got into the FDNY in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself one of those accidental firemen. You know, a lot of people come to New York and, you know, in the fire department, we get called OSWs, out-of-state workers. And, you know, but they've had this plan. They grew up loving the fire, you know, the idea of the fire department. They always wanted to be a fireman. That was definitely not me. I had no idea I was going to be a fireman. So I was just working in Baltimore. You know, as you said, I was a English major and took that degree and went straight to working in boatyards and with a carpenter for a few years and things like that. You know, nothing at all to do with English, but except that we spoke English. But then a friend of mine called me up and one day and she was like, "Hey, Rich," a friend from high school, you know, she's like, "Hey, Rich, why don't you come up to New York? I got this, you know, this job. I'm working as a production manager on a newspaper. You know, they put out like weekly newspapers and, you know, we need somebody to help lay out pages. And I got a roommate moved out of my apartment and this and that and the other." And I was like, "Yeah, why not? I moved to New York. That seems like a cool thing to do." You know, I was, you know, again, like I said, I was working in a boatyard. It wasn't like I wanted to make a entire life out of that. So I was like, "Yeah, I'll go to New York." And that's how I wound up there. And then I was there and I started thinking, man, sooner or later, I got to figure out something to do with my life before I turn, you know, I mean, anyway, I was pushing my late 20s at that point, you know, so.
Did you still have the mullet? Was the mullet still working or no?
No, unfortunately, I was already starting to grow this, you know, I think. So the mullet was only going to be a skullet at that point. Although I wish I could get it back.
Hell yeah, brother.
But so anyways, I wound up, I wonder how you become a fireman. I looked into it and it was like, they were given the test. And so, I just figured, oh, okay, that's cool. They give the test every couple months. I'll take it this time, you know? And as we know, you know, they really don't give the test that frequently, every 4 years at best. And so, you know, timing is everything. I've got a sort of a Forrest Gump quality sometimes of getting through, you know, my stages of life, you know?
Right. So I'm assuming we took the same test, which was what, 99?
Yeah.
99. Okay. So you did well, presumably you got to the top of the list, like I did. So you got on in February of 2001, right?
Yep.
So correct. A few months before me.
Yep.
So you went into the academy, and where'd you go right after that? You went on the first rotation?
So just like you, so me and Rob in one other class, there was three classes. We had this thing, they called it the 14-week program. And, you know, so we went to the academy for 10 weeks. And then my class was the only one that did it the way it was intended, because then 9/11 kind of screwed everything up as far as, you know, the world, but also as far as scheduling of, you know, the right. academy, you know. So, you know, I went 10 weeks to the academy, then I went for 14 weeks. So 7 weeks in an engine and 7 weeks in a truck. And when I did that, I was in Brooklyn and in the Avenue U Watchdogs in Gravesend, Brooklyn, which was a great house. I had a really, really
great.
I didn't
know that. All right.
Yeah. So I had a really great experience there. Really great introduction to the job. The guys there were fantastic. I mean, they were all about teaching and laughing and having a good time, you know, and I had my first fires there and everything. And then I went back to the academy for 3 weeks, which was weird because they didn't know what to do with us, because now we had already been in the field for 3 months, you know.
Right.
And then after that, I got assigned to Engine 292 in Woodside, which is the engine that shares quarters with Rescue 4. And so that was sort of my, I guess, my unintentional road into SOC, so that, you know, I guess I'm allowed to use names, but Steve Mikowitz, sure. You know, was a fireman at that point in Rescue 4, got promoted, went to Squad 18 and called me up and said, "Hey, Richie, why don't you come over?" And that was the road that I took to get to the West Village. So with right. 2 years on the job, which is, you know, and same with you, you know, like all the guys that were coming into SOC at that time had very little time on the job, you know, in current times, you don't go to SOC with that little bit of time on.
Sure.
But in our, you know, in our time, in me and Rob's time, you know, it was, you know, it was, you know, they just had so many holes to fill between the, you know, tremendous number of guys that died in SOC as well as guys that got out through medical reasons and also just through having had too much over the course of the, you know, the period after 9/11 and stuff like that. There was just a tremendous number of openings at that time. So lo and behold, me and Rob together wound up saving the world from the West Village out.
Right. So you're, as I mentioned earlier, you're recently retired, like me, with 9/11 related illnesses. Yes. We have the 20th anniversary coming up, which I know kicks a lot of stuff up for me, and I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through your 9/11? Were you working that day? Were you off? How'd you get there?
I was off. I was living in Long Island City, where I lived there for a number of years. And my, you know, my firehouse was in Woodside. It was a short drive. So, you know, I was laying in bed and reading a book, and my dad called me up. He's like, "Rich, you see the news?" And I turned on the TV and you know, it was all unfolding. It had just happened, the first plane. So, you know, I just jumped in my car immediately and drove to the firehouse. And then they did a full recall anyways. And they said, "Everybody, you know, go to your firehouses." So again, I wasn't working on duty, but as soon as we got to the firehouse, everybody just started gathering all the tools. Rescue 4 had gone down there on the, you know, second alarm or whatever alarm they gave it, as soon as they realized it was an airplane, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, all the guys were killed in Rescue 4. And so we just gathered all the tools that we could get out of the firehouse, everything that was still there, which of course there were plenty of tools. And somebody kind of flagged a bus, you know, an MTA bus on Queens Boulevard. And the bus driver had everybody, all the passengers get off, and we just loaded all the tools onto there. And then everybody that showed up at the firehouse, got on the bus and we went down. And so then we got to the West Side Highway, where they kind of held us for a little while they were trying to make sense of what was going on and get riding lists together too, so they could keep track of that. Cause there were so many rumors, as you remember, you know, there were so many rumors about who was alive, who was dead, who was missing, sure. Who wasn't, everything else, you know? I mean, you know, at one point they thought, if I remember right, they thought like 40,000 people had died, you know, or something, yeah. You know, I mean, it was really, you know, there was so much uncertainty going on. So once they got us so together, I had my group that I was with, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us, I think it was, if I'm remembering right. I don't want to be forgetting anybody, because it's an important group, you know. But sure. But and then the five of us, we stripped hose off of a engine that was parked there, and just, you know, folded up, and we had a length of hose on our shoulder, each of us. We had, you know, some hooks and stuff. You know, we just grabbed a couple, you know, tools, and, you know, we didn't know what we were going to need. You know, we just went walking in, and it was just, you know, and as I know you recall as well as I do, you know, it was just like you went from the gorgeous blue sky into, you know, Armageddon, you know, I mean, it was, you know, sure. Just like a blizzard, you know, but it was all, you know, of course, ash and smoke and everything else, you know.
And everything else. Yeah. So after that day, if I remember correctly, they went directly to the AB chart, right? So,
yeah. Yeah.
So how often did you actually go down? Because I know it was a little weird.
So for me, my experience was a little bit different, I think, than, some people or a lot of people's, because I was assigned to Engine 292. We had something like 12 guys on the roster, which is a really light roster. Yeah. So I did get sent down by the job a couple times, you know, in that early time. But basically what I did was we were on that, it was the ABC chart at first. And I would do my 24, and then I would get off in the morning, and every morning Rescue 4 had a vehicle that was at their disposal. At one point it was an ambulance that, you know, and at one point it was just a big van or whatever. And whoever could get on would get on, and we would just go down and just on our own time, you know, not on the job's time. And, um, And so that's what I would do. I just made a regular schedule. Just when I would get off in the morning, I would get on the vehicle, whatever we had, and go down, and I'd spend the day, you know, with different groups. I mean, I wound up most of the time with guys from Rescue 4 in those early days, which gave me some, I guess, some pretty like interesting, if for lack of a better word, you know, access, you know, yeah, so in the beginning I was there a lot, and then they kind of like put a stop to guys going in without having any, you know, without being on duty. Right. And so at that point, I don't remember when that was, in like sometime in November or December or whenever it was. I really don't remember. I didn't go for a couple months after that. And then in March, they were looking for volunteers. Like every month, they were looking for volunteers for guys to get go off the chart to go work the month at the so at the Trade Center. So for me, March, I wound up going down and being the, assigned there for the entire month of March. So.
Right. That's crazy. I remember, I think that's around that. That's when we started having all the firefighters from other places coming in, right? In those first couple of months.
And also just about March also. So, a point about March is, at that point it was down to the bedrock, you know, but there was the sides were still sloped up with debris, especially if, as I recall, it was like the northwest corner. So had a big hill of debris. And then they had previously been using the southeast corner as like a ramp for all the construction vehicles. Right. And, you know, the ramp, they just was just the debris, you know, but, and then they built that big steel, ramp down, you know, and then at that point we started digging up, that corner, that southeast corner. And so there was a tremendous number of, remains that were found in that month because of that, you know, and,
sure. Yeah. Rich wrote, a very moving piece about his experience at 9/11, which we'll put up a link to. But if we could just touch on a little bit of it, I know you were involved with finding at least one firefighter. Can you just walk us through that and tell us, you know,
sure,
what that experience was like?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. There was actually, you know, multiple firefighters that, but the one I think you're probably talking about was we were there one day. I don't remember which month it was, but it went from being called the pile to being called the pit, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and it was still like kind of the pile, but it was more almost like level at this point. And I guess, I mean, maybe it was still kind of the pile. It's hard to remember, but anyways, like we were there, in our group, you know, we all had like rakes and things like that, to sift through, the debris. And there was, we were working side by side with, a construction, like a grappler, you know, that would go in and it would like pull up a big, scoop of debris and it would kind of lay it out, you know, and then we would go like scraping through that. Then it would get scooped up and put in the back of a truck. And then that truck would get taken, that would get dumped, and that would get searched again. Then it would get reloaded back onto the truck. Then it would go to the Staten Island landfill and it would get searched again there. And so there, it was really like everything was searched multiple times, you know?
Right.
So at this point, the grappler came up and I just remember one of the guys yelling, he's like, he's like pointing, he's like, stop, stop, stop. And we look at, or you know, whatever he was yelling, you know, we look and you see two bunker boots hanging out of the bottom of this grappler. So like he had scooped up a fireman, you know, without realizing. And I can clearly remember just, it was actually, you know what, now that I think about it. So it was definitely, early on, you know, because, I'm going to interrupt myself just to say this one piece of the story, because
now you know what it's like.
But you know, at that point, like it was early enough that they hadn't really measured us for masks yet, because remember in the beginning, you just would grab whatever mask you could. And then at a certain point they measured you, then you had a card and you're like, I'm a large or whatever. And then
right.
You know, whatever it was. And then they would give you the proper mask and then you would have the proper, but the mask that I had at that time was not the right size at all. So, and I don't know if you can tell, I'll turn sideways for you, but I got a big nose, you know, so some people
never noticed. I never noticed,
So I'm wearing this mask and it's like crushing my nose and it's killing me the whole day as I'm working, you know? And so anyways, back to the grappler now. So the grappler's got the thing. Now these guys were absolute surgeons, whether they were when they started, I don't know, but just doing all that work at the World Trade Center, but maybe that was just so much working at it that they just got so good, but whatever the case may be, he laid down the debris in such a way. I still have no idea how he did this, because he had a thing full of debris, and he laid this fireman out perfectly, like no debris on him whatsoever, you know, debris all like wound up off to the side. And the guy was completely intact, you know, except for the fact that the grappler had just, you know, unfortunately ripped his like guts, his like stomach open or whatever. And he had, now it's like his innards were spilling out. It was really horrific, you know, but that was, again, it was like he had been preserved in the debris, which most people weren't, you know? Sure. And so when he was laid out, you know, like with all firemen or, I assume like any first responder works that were in uniform, if we could find any kind of identification, that was like the first thing we did, you know. So we were searching this guy's body and couldn't find any kind of identification. He had a chain on his neck with it was like a Taurus, you know. But I remember I was looking at it because I used to wear my badge, you know, like a little gold badge, you know, and stuff. And I was like, oh, maybe his badge number will be on there or whatever. I still to this day have no idea which firefighter this was, you know.
Oh, wow.
But so anyways, you know, and I was gagging. It, like terrified that I was going to throw up because I the smell was good because I had just these big gaps because I had this tiny little, you know, right. You know, mask on this big face of mine or whatever. And, you know, and, you know, that's basically it. And then we kind of got him into a body bag and sent him to the morgue and, you know, and we moved on, just went, continued, you know, the guy grappled another load. We raked through it and just the day went on, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of those gaps in your mask, we all know the controversy about the air quality and being told mm-hmm. it was safe to breathe and not to breathe. You actually were one of the guys who got sick early on, right? Before we went to Washington, before all these bills got passed.
Yeah.
You got sick and you were kind of left dangling by the FDNY and the national program. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Okay. So that, and as you know, like I hold bitterness about that, you know. I love the job, I love the fire department, I love the FDNY, but I love the union, I love the membership, but I was mad at everybody, and I still am a little bit because what happened with me was I wound up. So I was at Deutsche Bank also. So just real quick, the Deutsche Bank fire, for those people that are listening, that probably most people know what it is, but maybe they don't. It was a building that was on the fringe of that was heavily damaged in the World Trade Center collapse. And at one point they were renovating it. It had like a huge chunk dug out of the middle of it. And there, at one point they were renovating it, and then they stopped and they said, this is, you know, way too contaminated. And then they started doing a floor by floor abatement and then taking it down floor by floor. And then in 2007, you know, in the summer of 2007, you know, there was a fire there that wound up becoming a nightmare of a fire that where Joey Graffinino and Bob Badilla both died, you know, and stuff. And Squatty Team was there. I was one of the people working. We were basically stuck inside the building for a while, an hour and a half or whatever it was, while there was a record number of Maydays, like something like 28 Maydays given or something like that. Guys were lost all over the place. It's a whole nother story, the Deutsche Bank, for people that don't know it. I mean, it's worth reading up on and stuff. But anyways, after that, so I don't know whether it was that or 9/11, but in my mind, it was clearly one of those things that microscopic particles of whatever sort lodged inside my body. My body reacted by the antibodies started got tricked basically into thinking that my platelets were foreign bodies. So now it's fast forward. It was months later. Who knows how long this was going on, but months later, I went for my regular annual medical and I had almost no platelet. I was like a hemophiliac. I don't know how I didn't spontaneously start bleeding because people have on average 150,000 to 400,000 platelets. That, however the count works, but that's the number, you know. And I was down to 19,000 platelets, you know, I guess per whatever, you know, in my blood, you know, which they discovered at my medical, you know. So from that point, they put me onto medical leave. I had to go once a week to the to a hematologist, and they wouldn't make a line of duty because it's an extremely rare condition. And it's what they call idiopathic, which means that it's impossible to trace the source. So it's a triggered disease, though. It's not like it's a genetic disease or something like that, you know,
right.
And extremely rare in a male of my age at the time, you know, which I was in my, you know, somewhere in my 38, 37, whatever I was at the time. And, so for a year anyways, I spent the year on light duty going, you know, again, on my own time, on a day off from my light duty schedule, I would go take the train, pay for train, you know, to go into the city to see my hematologist. I'd have to pay for an extra day of daycare because I had a baby girl at home. Before I knew what it was, I'm like seeing my life flash in front of my eyes. I thought I had leukemia or something. I didn't know what was going on. You know, they wound up going into my spine and into my, I don't know if it was my spine or my upper hip or whatever it was, but to dig marrow out and to test it, you know, they tested my spleen. They did all kinds of stuff. And they determined it's like, yeah, it's this autoimmune disease that where you're, it's called ITP, where your antibodies are killing your platelets. So anyway, I rode through it. I tried to fight it. I tried the union. I tried, you know, the union's lawyers. I tried, you know, everything I could. But nobody really wanted to take the case because it was an idiopathic disease. It's impossible to prove. I used to argue. I say, well, just as you say, it's impossible to prove that it was caused by my exposures. It's impossible to prove that it wasn't also, you know, so I was really left hanging, and I didn't know. I thought my career was going to be over. Thankfully, you know, because, you know, the doctors were terrific, you know, and through all the treatments that I got. And then ultimately I wound up on taking like these four pills every day for the side effect that it would boost platelet production. So I would like kind of be producing them faster than I could kill them. And then I would get weaned off of it. Then they'd start dropping again. Then they'd go back on the drugs. Then they'd wean me. And after like the fourth or fifth time being weaned off of this drug, my body just stopped killing the platelets. Thank God, you know, and it hasn't come back, you know, so it's something that's always been in my head. Like, I'm always like wondering every time I get a blood test, am I going to have platelets? But it never did recur again. I knock on wood, you know, but
yeah. Well, and you must've had all those doubts whether or not your career was going to end. And
oh, without a doubt.
At that point, you would have been
depressed, you know?
Yeah. And that wouldn't have been considered a line of duty, right? So you would have just been put on disability and.
Yep. And not only that, but I was also, I was not quite, I didn't have 10 years on the job yet at that point. And 10 years is like a magic number because after that you collect a non-service disability pension. Whereas before, if I had been put out before 10 years, I just would be, you know, that's it. Not taken care of at all, you know? So, but again, like I got lucky as far as it goes, because it did go away and I did continue and do another, you know, 12 years of my career or whatever it was, you know, I guess in the end, I kind of look at it as all's well that ends well. I look at how terrible a lot of the ailments are that a lot of the guys that we worked with have gone through and even died, you know, and stuff. And I say, well, I can't really complain because I never even felt sick. I just knew that I was, you know,
right.
I even, if you remember, I even ran the marathon that year, you know?
Yeah. I know. I mean, your story was always something that caused a fire in my belly. I know that when I was down there, I definitely had your story in mind and Howie's, our colleague, Howie, a senior man, who had cancer before it was covered, you know, and just to think that all that time you spent going down there on your own time, volunteering, after you were told it was safe to go down there, to thank you for your service would be to get a kick out the door. What a slap in the face that would have been, but thankfully you recovered. You know, we don't have too much time left and you have a lot of stories. I mean, your career is bookended by the greatest terrorist attack on our nation and the greatest pandemic our generation has seen. But in the middle there, you've pretty much seen it all. I'd like to touch on something that I know happened because I want people to realize that a firefighter is never off duty, right? As you demonstrated, I mean, I think half the guys who died on 9/11 were off duty. But tell us about the time you were on your way to work and you witnessed somebody getting run over.
Yeah, that was pretty terrible. So it's when you're at work, you know, in the firehouse, you're in uniform and everything like that. You're expecting to go to, you know, who knows what, you know, and nothing shocking. I mean, it is shocking, but it's not shocking because you're there knowing that anything may happen that day, you know.
Well, after our career started, nothing is shocking, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know? And so the one day I was driving into work, and I was actually coming in early because I had to go to the Brazilian consulate for some reason, maybe to get a visa or something to go visit my wife's family. But I was coming over the Williamsburg Bridge into Manhattan, and as I got to the bottom, and now I get to the traffic light there, and I was like, I think I was like the third car. I was either the second or the third car, you know, from the traffic light. And I watch a construction truck, you know, turn onto Delancey Street. And I watched this guy, a 32-year-old, you know, guy, not like a kid, you know, but on a skateboard, and he grabbed onto the side of the truck, you know, and like skitching, whatever it's called. Yeah. I should have looked that up, you know. But I would have looked a lot cooler, you know. You know, whatever. But anyways, he grabbed the side of the truck, and I'm watching. I just in my head, I'm like, oh my god, this guy's crazy, you know. And then I watched his skateboard kind of do this like wiggle, like he just caught a bad wheel or like he hit a pebble or whatever happened. But I see him and I'm like, my heart's in my chest. And sure enough, boom, he goes up and he goes down, and he goes right under the wheels of this truck, you know? So I didn't see the wheels go over him because the car in front of me, you know, but I jumped out of my car and I run over to look, and I see some people had come off of the sidewalk and were next to him. And I thought, it just looked like, oh, okay, I guess he didn't get run over. God, that was a close call. I jump back in my car, you know, because I'm still in the middle of Delancey Street, you know. Okay. And I start to drive past, and I like look over, and I'm like, that guy's not moving, you know. So like I pulled over, I run back. There was a wonderful woman that turns out was a retired EMT who was holding neck stabilization on him, and it turns out I got to know her a little bit afterwards. She's a very religious woman, and she was speaking his last rites and stuff. And the guy, you know, his eyes were open, but he was in full shock. He was, you know, foaming at the mouth and everything. And I lifted his shirt to try to, and it was just a big growing purple bruise. Like he was just, you know, bleeding out internally, and it was horrible, really. There was not a whole lot that we could really do, you know. So like I got on my phone, and I know people had called 911. I called our dispatch and I said, listen, you know, we need to get this guy, needs a rush on the bus. He needs an ambulance immediately. He's got to get to a trauma surgeon if he's got any chance whatsoever, you know. And of course, you know, he was so severely damaged. I mean, he didn't survive. And he left behind like two young children. I actually got to know his parents and his sister a little bit. Like they got in touch with me afterwards, and you know, they wanted to meet me, which was touching but heartbreaking, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, so that's that story. It was pretty awful.
Yeah.
He had just opened up a skateboard shop in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, you know. But
terrible. And then you had to go to work, right? Yeah, Start your tour.
Yeah. And then I'm like, in my head, I'm like, this isn't supposed to bother me, you know. So I'm like trying to act all cool. Like, yeah, I just saw a guy get run over. But in my head, I'm just like, you know, I was like, I was off that whole night, you know.
Right. Speaking of which, I know you were on duty when the terrorist drove down the bike path, correct?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little about that? I know you guys pulled up on the scene pretty quickly.
Yeah. So my favorite day to work was always the gay pride parade and the Halloween parade.
Sure. Me too.
Yeah, totally. So our firehouse, for people that don't know where the Squad 18 is, it's like right in the route, you know. It's like, you are fully in the middle of it for both of those events, the Halloween and the pride parade, you know. And it's so much fun. I mean, there's such a good feeling in the air. Like, you know, it's so much fun to work. We never stop running from this moment we get there till we get, you know, get off, you know, the following day. But it's a lot of fun, you know? So anyway, it was another Halloween. I was all geared up. I was psyched. I'm working Halloween. It was the afternoon and we get the run. So, you know, for people that don't remember what the story was this guy had, it was like a lone wolf terrorist, you know, like he was, I think he was like operating on his own, if I'm not mistaken. And he had gone and he had rented a pickup truck from like a Home Depot or a Lowe's or something. And what he wound up doing was he came and he just drove down the West Side Highway, veered up onto the bike path that runs alongside of it, and just like rode for like, I'm not sure how far, pretty far though, like just like plowing over people on this bike path. And then he came out somewhere down in like, you know, in lower Manhattan, and he rammed into a school bus full of kids. Thankfully, nobody got hurt on the school bus. And then he got out, you know, now his truck was disabled. He got out and I don't think he got killed. He got shot in the stomach or something. I don't remember the end result of it, but I know that he was captured anyway, whatever, right. Obviously, at that point. So the 911 calls that were coming in were because this truck had driven into a school bus. Nobody had called about the bike path. Nobody knew about the bike path, you know? And so we were responding as a SOC unit going to a severe, you know, like automobile accident. And as we're driving down the West Side Highway, we had Sheldon from Squad One was the detail that day. I remember him saying, he's like, man, there's a lot of people laid out on the bike path. Something to that effect. He said something like he was noticing that people were laid out. So we start looking, and as we like lean over to look out the window, there was a cop, you know, like that, or somebody anyway. I didn't see because I was in the back, you know. But somebody was out like waving, you know, like trying to flag us down. So Adrian, who was the boss, like she had Brian, who was driving, you know, had Brian pull over. We jumped out. We all grabbed like all the medical bags that we have on the rig. You know, we had at that point, we also had a mass casualty. I think we had that at that point. Anyways, we just grabbed all of our medical bags that we had, ran over, and right away we're just, as soon as we got onto the bike bed, there's three people laying there. You know, one's got like the, you know, like a big hole in their head, you know, like, and, you know, stuff just leaking out, you know, obviously dead. Another one had like their leg broken so severely that the foot was pointed up toward their head, and it was just like, it was horrific, you know? And so we start trying to work on them. I'm looking around, I'm like, there's people there, you know, we have six people, five, because, you know, at that point, Brian's on the rig, just trying to raise dispatch and trying to give information, you know, like trying to get more units sent to us, not just where they were all going. We're watching fire engines and ambulances zoom past us on the West Side Highway and trying to raise them on the radio, you know, and stuff like that. Eventually Rescue One actually spotted us. And at a certain point it was us and Rescue One, but for what seemed like an infinite amount of time, it was probably not that long, but it seemed like an incredible amount of time. It was just us, you know, and something like 20 people laid out, you know.
Oh, wow.
And so Adrian, you know, she had run down, you know, like run north up the bike path, you know, and she gets on the radio. She's like, Richie, I need a tourniquet, you know. So I grab my bag. These guys are working on these people here. I grab my bag and I'm running toward Adrian. And it's like the old thing that we would learn in like mass casualty incidents is the idea of triage. You have to kind of, it's a horrible thing to have to do, but you have to pick and choose, you know. So I see somebody sitting there just kind of like moaning and stuff like that, but seem like they're okay. That person can wait, you know, I see someone, you know, that got thrown into the bushes, you know, I remember one person literally had their head backwards, you know, cause like, they got their neck broken so badly and I ran up to Adrian and there was, this guy who was conscious and he was laying there and he was just like bleeding severely from his like upper leg. And his friend was with him. It wasn't injured. It was just like, you know, it's completely distraught. These were, I forget what they were from. They were from South America somewhere. It was like a high school reunion or something like that. But like a big group, like a big tourist group had come from like Argentina or so. I forget where they were from. But the guy was, you know, he was at that point he was conscious, but he was, you know, not coherent, you know, but he was, and I remember, you know, pulling out the tourniquet, ripping up his shirt and like, going to take his, you know, cut his pants off. And I see that he was, you know, thinking that he had like a big, a wound on his leg and I was going to try to get the tourniquet as high as I could, you know, get it above the wound so I could, you know, again, to stop the bleeding or whatever. Right. But he was ripped from his groin up, like all the way up across his belly. And, you know, like, nothing to tourniquet. I mean, he was just So, you know, so I, what I did was I just, the only thing I could think to do, I just like stuffed it with as much, you know, trauma dressings as I could. Then I got oxygen on him right away, you know, and, you know, and he was kind of breathing on his own at that point, but he was fading, and then he wasn't really breathing on his own. So then I took that off and I started, you know, I was going to go put the bag valve mask, you know, that you squeeze, you know, like the bag valve mask onto him. And I remember trying to open his mouth, which I did to get an OPA, in other words, to hold his tongue from blocking his airway. And I remember like pushing his lip, and it just like held my, it just like my fingerprint, you know, just like stayed indented in his lip because he had no perfusion left. It, like he had bled so much, you know. And then Santos came around and came to help. Richie Miranda from Rescue One, you know, he was there like helping. And you know, and we're finally now the ambulances start arriving. So now we get the guy. We load him onto the ambulance with like two other victims and three paramedics all stuffed on the back of this ambulance. And me and Santos get in the front. And I pulled up the GPS, and Santos was driving, and we just sped to the hospital. Got to the hospital, Beekman, you know, and then when they opened the door, they said, you know, they had already declared him dead. Wow. You know. And it hit me in the heart. It really, you know, I mean, you know, we're no strangers to losing, you know, victims, but for some reason, this was one of those that just like, it hit me like really hard, you know, but I guess just like the overwhelming, I guess, tragedy of, and like, I don't know, man, just like what kind of sense does it make? And you know, just to cause that kind of, you know, death and damage for what, you know, to prove what point, you know, but, yeah. You know, it was a tough one.
So now, after this incident, did the job send anybody by the firehouse to talk to you guys?
Or? Yes, they did. At this point, you know, the counseling unit is terrific on our job. And before 9/11, it was like a very small unit. And then 9/11 really created this wonderful support system in our counseling unit. A friend of both of ours, Richie Portello, who's one of the greatest men I think that has ever been on the job, you know, retired as a chief, you know, as me and you both know, you know, but he at this point was now retired. He had been put out. He had tore his shoulder or something. And, you know, after a long career, you know, a long, very, very storied career, you know, but anyway, he's been working with the counseling unit. So he came by and talked, and he's easy to talk to, you know, cause we're, you know, friends, you know, at this point. Right. And stuff. And it was helpful. I remember, I didn't take any time or anything. I just kept, you know, but it definitely like my, it took a little while for my head to snap back to being right, you know, for sure.
If that ever happens, right?
Yeah.
Now, what about now? I mentioned earlier you're retired, right? You moved out to Colorado recently. Yeah. As we can see, you're still decorating. I found when I retired, you know, once I stopped moving and just sat back and relaxed, that all these things, all those incidents, started creeping back in my mind, you know, like you said, you got to kick them to the side when you're on duty. Right.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can't, sometimes things like that happen that eat away at you. Do you find any of these things coming back on you now? How are you feeling?
I mean, it's hard to say. I'm so distracted right now with, you know, with this move and with trying to get, you know, my kids started school already, you know, out here, they're very cruel. They put the kids in school in like the middle of August, you know, but things do, you know, always, you know, it's always easy for it to like just flunk, you know, like stick itself back into my head, you know, whatever it is, sometimes it's funny stuff and sometimes it's horrible stuff, you know, but this time of year, I mean, it always gets weird. And like you had mentioned it earlier, you know, like about how, you know, and like every year from 9/11 on, it's always been this way. August is always a weird month because you don't really realize it's happening, but it's like, it's starting to like really like worm its way into your mind. And then all of a sudden it's September 11th and, you know, out of nowhere, like, you know, like I'll be sitting in the car and all of a sudden I'm crying, you know, and I'm like, what, where did that come from? You know, but.
Sure. Yeah. I've noticed that too. You know, because you know, Kristen's father was killed on 9/11, and I've noticed the last few weeks that we're a little short with each other, and we both start slipping into, you know, depression and anger without realizing it. Next thing you know, we're having an argument over nothing. And then I sat back and looked at my calendar and was like, oh, yeah, you know, it's that time of year again. You know, and we obviously talked about it. But I hope you're talking to people, because I'm a big advocate for mental health, especially with physical conditions. You know, we've linked, Dr. Moline at Mount Sinai has linked PTSD with the acceleration of the 9/11 illnesses, as you probably know. But the great thing is, even out in Colorado, you can still visit World Trade Center doctors, right? I mean, the program's everywhere. So for the people listening out there, as Rich alluded to earlier, we had volunteers showing up at the World Trade Center for months, right? From all over the country, all 50 states. So if you're in any of those states, you can go visit a doctor and at least get your yearly medical done. So that's the beauty of the program that we got set up. But as Rich said, sometimes there's things you can't kick to the side, right? So you got to talk about it. You can't let it eat away at you, because that's when your body starts eating away at itself. That's what I think. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, when you're in the firehouse, you know, people would ask, you know, like, how do you deal with it and stuff like that? I said, well, you know, you're in the firehouse, and you know, it's like, without even realizing it, you're in therapy all the time, because we're all sitting around together at the kitchen. You know, the kitchen is where all the world problems are solved, right? And like all our personal problems and world problems, as well as creating brand new ones all the time for each other, you know, when we break each other's chops, you know. But but it's something like, you can always talk about the stuff there, you know? So like, you know, and joke, you know, there's a lot of gallows humor that comes with the fire department, you know?
Yeah.
You know, there's like the one, you know, it's kind of horrible and funny at the same time, but like that, you know, I remember we had a run, and a guy had jumped off of a roof and landed in this courtyard, and he was like, it was like the most strange thing ever, but the way he had landed, it was like he was like half buried in the mulch, and like you know, and it was like perfect. It was like it was done on purpose, you know, like anyway, we deal with it. The guy was clearly dead, and we get back on the rig, and I remember you know, one of the guys who I guess I won't say his name, but one of the guys saying, talk about taking a dirt nap. You know, it's like that's just like the typical, you know, fire department gallows humor, you know.
Right. But I always felt without those jokes, it'd be tough to get through it. Right. I mean, that's humor, and you don't really understand it unless you're living through it. You know,
but you got to be able to make yourself laugh. You know, I mean, it just, otherwise you'll go crazy, you know?
Yeah. And that was one of my favorite things about working with you is, you seem to deal with these things the same way I do, you know, with positivity and jokes.
Yeah.
So I always appreciated that. So speaking of positivity, I know you're a poet. You're an amateur guitar player.
At best.
I was wondering if you had anything you'd like to share with the people out there who might not know the NAV.
You know, it's funny, because I do play guitar, and I love to write songs, and I'm very, very I'm very like shy about it, and yet I make these little videos, and like I put them out for the world to see, you know, the world on Facebook or whatever, you know, so that, you know, then I'm just like, you know, screw it, you know, if they want to you know, like point their finger and laugh, let them, you know. But but yeah, I mean, I could try. I mean, I don't really have to. My big problem is I'm very bad with memorization, but I can give it a shot. So if you'll have to forgive me if I mess up some words, but I'll play. Because you gave me a little warning that you were going to ask me this, so I got my guitar by myself. So I was thinking about it. What are the closest songs that I have to being memorized? And I got like a love song, you know, because I'll do a little love song for you. This one's called "That's Okay," and I may have to do you know, we may have to say cut and do another take, because I'm sure I'll mess up. But here we go. Well, I ain't got a lot, but I got my girl and the children that she gave me. They are my world. If I get nothing else, that's okay. There couldn't be anything better than today. Well, we both go to work and come home again. Every time that I see her, I hold her hand. Maybe we got debt, that's okay. There couldn't be anything better than today. Well, we haven't stopped loving since the day we wed. Standing nervous in the courthouse, then running home to bed. If we ever get old, that's okay. There couldn't be anything better than today. Well, I ain't got a lot, but I got my girl and the children that she gave me. They are my world. If I get nothing else, that's okay. There couldn't be anything better than today. There couldn't be anything better than today. There you go.
Well, that was great, buddy. I can't think of a better note to end my very first episode on.
Thanks a lot, man.
Well, I hope you will join me again and tell some more of your stories.
I would love to. Love
and
to.
Share your positivity mission with the world. You can find Rich's songs on YouTube, right? What's your YouTube channel?
Either my name, Richard Navieski, or The One Nav, like T-H-E, one, the number, you know, N-A-V.
One's all we need.
So that's it. The One, but the one, not the word, the number, N-A-V.
All right.
And that should find it. And also, if you want to look at my little pictures that I put in my my kids' lunches all the time, go to Instagram and look up Lunch Bag Treasures.
You got one for us?
Yeah, I got this was yesterday's, but it just happens to be one of my favorites. Let me see if I can pop up on the screen here.
The Riddle of the Stinks. What smells? And we got a little Sphinx-looking character there. Oh, he looks like he's tooting.
I mean, tell me that's not hilarious. Come on.
That's very Nav. So anyway, man, thank you for being my first guest.
My pleasure.
Thank you for your service to our city and our country.
Thank you.
I know it probably makes you uncomfortable, but you are a hero and you earned every minute of your retirement. I hope you're enjoying it with that.
I am. Thank you. And Rob, you know, I feel the exact same way about you. What you've done has been absolutely tremendous. You've done more than so many people to get bills passed and everything else. You know, the time that you spent on the job and the time that you spent after it have been tremendous, you know.
All right, man. Well, thanks, bro. And hopefully you get through 9/11 this year unscathed, and we'll share a beer together soon.
Sounds great. I look forward.
All right, brother. Be well. Right.
You too.
Hey, everyone. It's Frankie, and today we're making Nanny's tomato basil pasta. Here are the ingredients. 5 Roma tomatoes diced, 1 cup fresh basil chopped, 4 cloves garlic chopped or minced, 1 pound of your favorite pasta, 1/2 cup of extra virgin olive oil, more as needed, salt and pepper, and basil leaves for garnish. Today my nanny is making a very delicious summer dish. The tomatoes and basil are already washed and are dried off, and the garlic is ready to chop. Right now she's chopping the tomatoes. Now that the tomatoes are chopped in small pieces, my nan is going to pour them into the bowl and start with the basil. Before she starts doing the basil, she has to wipe all of the tomato juice off the cutting board so it's nice and clean. Now she's going to start ripping off the basil and she's going to cut them up. Now that we're done with the basil, we're going to put the rest of it to the side for later and start chopping up the garlic. You could either cut up the garlic by hand
or you could put it into the garlic press. About 3 or 4 cloves should do it. Now that we're done with the garlic, we're going to put in 1/2 cup of olive oil and salt and pepper to taste. Now that we're done putting everything in the bowl, we're going to mix it up with a spoon and put it in the refrigerator for 1 hour. After bringing the water to a boil, pour in the pasta and let it cook for 10 to 12 minutes, stirring occasionally. Next, we're going to strain the macaroni, then put it back into the pot. Now we're going to pour the tomato mixture into the pasta. And mixing it up. Now we pour it into the bowl. Now we're gonna sprinkle some cheese. And we're gonna garnish with the leftover basil leaves. Okay, dig in.
Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks to my family. Thanks for all your support. I love you. Couldn't do any of this without you. Of course, thanks to Rich Navioski. Thanks for sharing your stories and your positivity. You're a hero, man. Thanks to people over at Righteous Media. I've really been looking forward to checking this one off my bucket list. Be sure to give us 5 stars and subscribe now and fire up every episode. And check out firefighters.us for more great content, video, and some awesome Firefighters podcast merch. We've got hats and t-shirts and a lot more coming soon. I'll be dropping more episodes every week, and I'll talk to other firefighters sharing their stories that rarely get told. The real men and women that save lives and make a difference. I learned one thing when my health issues forced me to retire and forced me to speak up. It's that my hands may shake, but my voice surely doesn't. Stay low, my friends.
Righteous Media.